intent of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Pat Perry from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Today's stories include five scooter companies want to enter Durham market, and for young investors, Jumpy Market presents first big test. And we'll begin with five scooter companies want to enter the Durham market. Hundreds of electric scooters will arrive on Durham streets this spring. All that's left is paperwork before the city grants permits to five companies who have applied: Lime, Bird, Spin, Lyft, and Gotcha. At least 600 scooters will be allowed, likely starting in March. Bird and Lime are already in Raleigh. Spin already lists Durham and Duke University on its website as a city and campus where they have scooters, as well as Charlotte and other cities. Lyft scooters are in the Washington, D.C. area, in California, Nashville, and Atlanta, among other large cities. Gotcha scooters are mostly found on college campuses. Lime and Spin bikes are already in Durham. Interim Transportation Director Bill Judge said the goal for granting the permits is March 1st, but it could be later. The city will grant permits to all companies at the same time. While the Raleigh City Council passed its scooter rules months after electric scooters arrived there, the Durham City Council asked Bird and Lime to wait while the council figured them out. We were happy, I guess, that we didn't encounter what other cities did, where they just brought scooters before they were ready, Judge said. The Durham City Council passed its ordinance in October. While Raleigh is charging a $300 per scooter fee, in Durham it is only $100. Durham also requires a $1,000 initial application fee. Servando Esparza of Bird said in October that the company wants to deploy at least 100 scooters in Durham. "We tend to start with a number and grow with demand," he said. "In a larger city like Durham, it will be more than 100. Durham's transportation department had two big departures recently. Director Terry Bellamy, who left for a job in Prince George's County, Maryland, and Brian Poole, who left for a job in Portland, Oregon. Dale McKeel, who is now handling scooters, said the permitting is taking a little longer as a result. Poole had said in October that he expected scooter permits to be granted in January. McKeel said that details left to work out include making sure the companies can follow all the regulations, like reducing barriers to low-income residents. The companies will need to include payment options for riders who don't have a smartphone or credit card, as well as deploy at least 20% of their scooter fleets in low-income areas. "We believe all five can comply with the ordinance and meet our requirements," Judge said. "Market forces will determine whether all five choose to launch here." The scooter ordinance passed in October also dealt with bicycles. Judge said they set the scooter cap at 600 because they scapped bike shares at 1,200. But with no applications for bike permits and few bike share bikes on the street, that could mean more scooters. "There are about 200 bike share bikes in Durham today," Judge said, "down from 500. But that's also because it's winter," he said. Durham scooters rules require riders to be at least 16 years old and wear a helmet, follow traffic laws, not ride on sidewalks, and not ride on greenway trails. And next, for young investors, Jumpy Market presents First Big Test. After gliding through years where stocks mostly just rose, a generation of investors last year suddenly confronted a hard financial truth. Stocks are risky and can plunge at any moment. For older investors, the nearly 20% drop in the S&P 500 index from late September through Christmas Eve was a reminder of the fear that gripped markets during the 2008 financial crisis, though not as bad. But for many investors in their 20s and early 30s, it was the first test of their mettle since they opened 401k and brokerage accounts. So, how did they do? The answer is crucial because these younger savers are on the hook to pay more of their retirements than their parents or grandparents. The fear was that many would panic at their first brush with a severe downturn, sell their stocks, and lock in the losses. Investing is an area where many experts say a participation trophy is an unquestionably good thing. Given enough years, stocks have gone on to recover from every one of their past declines. Early indications are that millennial investors generally avoided panic. And not only are they still participating, but many embraced the volatility and saw it as an opportunity to buy more stocks at lower prices, according to data from brokerages. At Fidelity, for example, millennial investors put in twice as many buy as sell orders for stocks and stock funds during the last 3 months of 2018, when the S&P 500 plunged 14% for its worst quarterly performance in nearly 7 years. They were actually more aggressive about buying stocks than they were a year earlier at the end of 2017, when the S&P 500 closed out one of its strongest and calmest years in decades. Older generations of investors also embraced the tumult in recent months and picked up their buying activity for stocks, though they were not as aggressive as millennials. Baby boomers had roughly 1.3 buy orders for every sell order during last year's fourth quarter, for example. The data cover Fidelity's 20.8 million retail brokerage accounts. The decision did not come stress-free. Consider Marcus Harris, a 35-year-old internal medicine physician in the Houston area. Last summer, when stocks were setting record after record, Harris felt confident that he would be able to handle a severe downturn, even though he had yet to experience one in his 5 years of investing. When the market started skidding on worries about a slowing economy and President Donald Trump's trade war with China, though, Harris acknowledges he felt some trepidation. He had set his phone to notify him when some of the stocks he owns hit certain prices, both on the high and the low end. At work, as the S&P 500 careened lower in December to its worst month in nearly a decade, he got used to hearing often from his phone. It was probably five times a day he said, "Ding, the stock has hit your low. Ding, that stock hit your low." It was a little scary looking at my retirement account saying, "Man, that's a lot of salary gone," he recalled. Harris eventually turned off notifications. But he also said he knew he had many years to go before he needed to use the money. He ended up putting more money into stocks late last year, hoping to buy low. "I got age on my side," Harris said. "This is a 30-year plan." The reaction was similar from many clients of Charles Oddy, financial advisor at Blueprint 360 in Houston. Before the downturn, Oddy had discussed many times with his clients market volatility and the importance of sticking with an investment plan. But he got more worried calls than he was expecting as markets tumbled. You think your clients are going to act one way because you have these conversations and they reassure you they know the game plan, but you really don't know what's going to happen in the moment, he said. More often than not, the conversation I had was, "You told me there was going to be some fluctuations, but I didn't understand what you meant. Are we going to change the plan?" In the end, most held steady. Only four of his clients moved their investments out of stocks and into cash, and three of them were older. For many of his younger clients, he suggested viewing the drops as an opportunity to double down on stocks they were familiar with and had already reaped gains from, such as Netflix, Amazon, and marijuana stocks. Many agreed. Millennial investors were close to flat in terms of being net buyers or sellers of stocks at TD Ameritrade. That's similar to how they behaved in 2015 when the S&P 500 lost more than 10% in 1 5-day stretch. Not freaked out at all, said J.J. Kinahan, chief market strategist at TD Ameritrade. My theory, given the limited sample size, is that because of their age, they're willing to take more risk and see it as a buying opportunity. Of course, the customers at TD Ameritrade are a self-selected group of people, those who chose to invest. The majority of younger households don't own any stock at all. A shade more than 41% of all households led by someone under 35 own stocks in some way, according to the latest data from the Federal Reserve. For all other age groups, except those 75 or older, more than half of the households own stocks. The figures include both people who actively trade stocks and others who have a target date retirement mutual fund in a 401k they never touch. But the rate of stock ownership has been going up in recent years for younger households. The most recent tally from 2016 showed the highest rate of ownership for young households since 2007, before the financial crisis hit its peak. Recent weeks have brought some relief for investors, as the S&P 500 has climbed about 12% since hitting a bottom on Christmas Eve. That includes Harris, the doctor whose phone was dinging so often in December. A few days after Christmas, he said, "I turned the notifications back on." And next, the shutdown projected to cause $3 billion permanent hit to the economy. The federal government shutdown will cause slight permanent harm to the economy, about $3 billion, according to a report Monday by the Congressional Budget Office. The report says the 5-week shutdown has slowed growth in the near term, but that most of the lost growth will eventually be recovered. Overall, CBO predicts that just $3 billion in lost gross domestic product will be permanently lost, a modest figure in a $20 trillion-plus economy. By year's end, CBO says GDP would be just 0.02 smaller because of the shutdown, which shuttered many domestic agencies. Most of the 800,000 furloughed federal workers are returning to their jobs. Most broadly, the report estimates a drop in GDP growth to 2.3% this year as the effects of President Donald Trump's tax cut on business investment begin to drop off. It also says that the U.S. budget deficit will hit $897 billion this year. The CBO credits the 2017 tax bill, which cut corporate and individual income taxes by $1.9 trillion over a decade, with a burst in growth last year. But it says that this year the boost that recent tax legislation gave to business wanes. The report comes as the government is reopening after a 35-day partial shutdown. The CBO says the shutdown will have a modest negative impact on the economy, lowering projections of economic growth by 0.4 percentage points to 2.1% in the first quarter, though the economy is expected to mostly make up for it over the rest of the year. The shutdown dampened economic activity mainly because of the loss of furloughed federal workers' contribution to gross domestic product, the delay in federal spending on goods and services, and the reduction in aggregate demand, the report said. Underlying those effects on the overall economy are much more significant effects on individual businesses and workers, CBO said. Among those who experience the largest and most direct negative effects are federal workers, who faced delayed compensation in private sector entities that lost business. Some of those private sector entities will never recoup the lost income. The CBO report predicts a $118 billion increase over last year's $779 billion deficit. It predicts that the economy will grow by 2.3% this year, a slowdown from the 3.1% last year. Unemployment would fall to 3.5% in the second half of the year, its lowest point since the 1960s. The report lands in a divided Washington, where neither Trump nor Democrats controlling the House are expected to make curbing the deficit a priority. In fact, Trump and lawmakers are likely to increase spending for the Pentagon and other federal agencies, which would otherwise face cuts from outdated budget caps that are the remnant of the 2011 budget deal. And Congress is ultimately going to face pressure to make permanent provisions of the 2017 tax cuts for individuals that would otherwise expire in 2025. Republicans' massive tax giveaway to millionaires and big corporations is inflicting serious damage on our budget outlook, said House Budget Committee Chairman John Yarmuth, Democrat, Kentucky. We are facing trillion-dollar deficits and an increasingly bleak fiscal future. The agency also predicts that Trump's trade policies, higher tariffs on Chinese goods and products, such as imported steel, would only have a relatively modest negative impact on the economy. The shutdown dampened economic activity mainly because of the loss of the furloughed federal workers' contribution to gross domestic product, the delay in federal spending on goods and services, and the reduction in aggregate demand. And that's from the Congressional Budget Office report. And next, agency criticizes Sears chairman's plan to buy bankrupt retailer. The federal agency preparing to take over Sears pension plans is opposing Sears chairman Edward Lampert's plan to buy the retailer out of bankruptcy. Lampert's $5.2 billion bid to buy the Hoffman Estates-based retailer's 425 stores seeks to keep the company in business and says it will preserve 45,000 jobs. A committee of Sears' unsecured creditors on Monday filed an objection to the proposed sale to Lampert. The Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, a member of that committee, added independent objections in Saturday's filing with the U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the Southern District of New York. The agency covers individuals' pensions up to certain limits. If an insured pension plan shuts down without enough money to pay all the benefits, the PBCG said earlier this month it would seek to take over Sears' plans, which cover more than 90,000 people by January 31st, after concluding the retailer's continuation of the plans was no longer possible. The agency estimates Sears owes it more than $1.7 billion, according to the Saturday court filing. While the PBGC is a federal agency, it is not funded by taxpayer dollars. Its operations are financed by insurance premiums, investment income, and recoveries from failed single-employer plans. Sears entered into a 5-year pension protection plan with the agency in 2016. That agreement gave the PBGC an interest in intellectual property related to the Kenmore Appliance and Die Hard Auto Products brands to protect the PBGC if Sears' finances deteriorated. The company's proposed sale would leave those brands under control of Lampert's hedge fund, ESL Investments, according to the PBGC. In a court filing earlier this month, the Unsecured Creditors Committee claimed ESL's $5.2 billion proposal is nothing but the final fulfillment of a years-long scheme to deprive Sears and its creditors of assets and its employees of jobs while lining Lampert's and ESL's own pockets. Sears and ESL could not immediately be reached for comment. ESL has denied the committee's allegations and said the transactions with the retailer had the approval of the company's board and independent advisors and were done in good faith on fair terms, beneficial to all Sears stakeholders. Lampert's proposal to buy the company still needs the bankruptcy court's approval, and a hearing has been scheduled for February 4th. And next, stocks slide as slow growth in China weighs on earnings. Stock indexes sank Monday after twin announcements highlighted how much China's slowing economic growth is hurting profits for U.S. companies. Caterpillar, a bellwether for industrial companies, reported fourth quarter earnings that fell well short of analyst expectations and said that it expects construction equipment sales growth in China to be flat in 2019 following years of significant growth. Chip maker NVIDIA, meanwhile, cites slowing demand in China as one of the reasons for slashing its forecast for fourth quarter revenue. Wall Street had already been fixated on the effects of China's slowdown, particularly with trade tensions high between Washington and Beijing. And the announcement sent the technology and industrial sectors to sharp losses. They helped drag the S&P 500 down 20.91 points, or 0.8%, to 2,643.85. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 208.98, or 0.8%, to 24,528.22. The NASDAQ Composite lost 79.18, or 1.1%, to 7,085.68. And the Russell 2000 Index of small cap stocks dropped 9.32, or 0.6%, to 1,473.54. China, The world's second largest economy generated its slowest economic growth last year since 1990, and the impact is being felt widely among the many U.S. companies that rely on China for sales, especially industrial and technology companies. China accounts for 5.5% of all revenue for S&P 500 companies, second most in the world after the U.S., according to FactSet. NVIDIA and Caterpillar fell to the sharpest losses in the S&P 500 with drops of 13.8% and 9.1%, respectively. Tech giants Microsoft and Apple were also weighed down by China concerns. Microsoft fell 2% and Apple shed 0.9%. Apple shook markets earlier this month when it warned of lagging sales in China. Christina Hooper, chief global market strategist at Invesco, expects a widespread impact from the global slowdown and says Apple was the canary in the coal mine. This, if nothing else, is putting more emphasis and focus on U.S.-China trade talks this week, she said. Talks aimed at resolving the impasse over China technology policy and other issues are due to resume in Washington this week. Analysts say there might be more moves to trim China's massive trade surplus with the U.S. that could stave off further hikes in punitive tariffs imposed by both sides. However, they expect gaps to remain on key problems such as China's blueprint for state-led development of leading technologies. The trade meeting is just one of several big events that could swing markets in a very busy week. Also upcoming are a meeting by the Federal Reserve on interest rates, the U.S. jobs report, and earnings reports from about a quarter of the companies in the S&P 500 index. Investors are hoping for encouraging clues that interest rates will remain low enough and job growth strong enough so as to avoid a recession. Fear of a potential recession took its toll on the stock markets at the end of 2018, and the S&P 500 fell nearly 20% between setting its record on September 20th and Christmas Eve. In Europe, the threat of a continued economic slowdown has been hanging over what is an already contentious situation with Britain's expected departure from the European Union in March. Economic growth in Europe slowed in the last half of 2018, and indicators at the start of this year have been weak. We've run out of time for today's episode of Money Matters. I hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Pat Perry, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's reading of Money Matters is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.